Welcome to the 297th episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I'm your host, Randy Winograd. In this edition of the podcast, our topics are a review of Patrick's weekend predictions, looking back at the college football playoff national championship game, a review of the divisional round in the NFL playoffs, and our weekly look back at the last week of college basketball and the NBA. With all that content, let's jump right in quickly here with a look back at Patrick's weekend predictions, which are posted every Thursday on our social media handles, those handles being at 4thand24.com. In the NFL, Patrick went 2-2 with his weekend predictions. In the NBA, Patrick went 2-2 with his weekend predictions. And in significant college basketball action, Patrick went 1-3 with his predictions. Brought Patrick to a 5-7 week uncharacteristic. Brings him to a 1,261 and 785 overall record. That is a 61.6% winning percentage. Patrick, your thoughts on your weekend predictions?
Well, like you said, I think uncharacteristic is a good enough way to describe it. It definitely wasn't my best week, but at the same time, you know, it happens with a lot of close college basketball matchups. It happens with a lot of close NBA games. This is the point of the season where injuries just kind of randomly creep into games and hard to predict. And also, you know, two really, really close games in the NFL that didn't go my way, and one big upset, and I'll talk about those right now. The Chiefs beat the Texans, which I got right. The Eagles beat the Rams, which I got right, but then the other two I got wrong. The Commanders beat the Lions, obviously that being an upset, and then the Bills beating the Ravens. We'll talk more about that game when we actually cover the NFL, but that is why I went 2-2 that week. I picked the road upset of the Ravens just because they were my Super Bowl pick. Didn't think they showed anything particularly amazing last week and didn't think the Bills showed anything that really won me over either. It was definitely pretty much a pick 'em game, and it felt like one, and it was one. It came down to 2-point conversion, but, you know, didn't get that one right. And then the Commanders coming out and beating the Lions, I think that definitely was a bigger surprise, although, you know, the Lions all year long haven't really had much of a secondary because of injuries, and they got three more defensive backs injured during that game. So it's not entirely surprising that ended up happening. If there was one team that was really just ruined by injuries all year long, it was them. So not too surprising that if you had told me they were going to lose three more defensive backs in the middle of that game to injuries, I probably would have said that the Commanders would win, because I wouldn't even know who was playing for the Lions at that point. And then in the NBA, the Celtics beat the Magic 121-94. I got that right. The Nuggets beat the Heat 133-113, which I got right. But the Timberwolves beat the Knicks 116-99, which has now turned into like a little bit of a mini rivalry, East-West at least. It's hard to build those, but you know, this might be one based on that trade. The Cat trade in the offseason, of course. And then the Mavs beat the Thunder 106-98. Thunder don't lose much nowadays, and the Mavs have been dealing with a lot of injuries. So a really good win for the Mavs. Definitely a surprising one. And then in college basketball, I tried to it's always the safest thing to just pick the four home teams. You're never going to do worse than 2-2. But I tried to pick the road upset this week, and then it kind of backfired because there were two road upsets and I picked the wrong one. Number four, Alabama beat number eight, Kentucky 102-97, which I lost. That one I really went back and forth on. I ended up just picking Kentucky just because of home court. But, you know, analytics said that game was basically within 0.2, 0.3 points heading into the game. And the number 17 Purdue beat number 13 Oregon on the road 65-58. That one I felt a lot more confident about, that Oregon was going to win that one. They have the interior rim protection to deal with Trey Kaufman running. I thought good enough guards to match Braden Smith and Fletcher Lawyer, but that was not true. Then number 15 Mississippi State beat number 21 Ole Miss 84-81 in overtime, one of the best games of the week. Got that one right. And then I picked Illinois to go on the road and beat Michigan State, but they did not. Number 12, Michigan State ends up with the win 80-78. Literally came down to a final possession. Illinois turning it over with a chance to tie the game pretty late, and then also turning it over again at the end of the game. So, you know, really, really close games in college basketball. Kentucky brought that game down to like a 2 or 3 point game at some point right near the end too. So could have gone either way on three of those games. And even the one that I felt couldn't have gone either way was only a 7 point margin victory. So really close games. And, you know, I will hope to do better next week. And I've had some recently, I've had some really good weeks, so I'm not too upset about it.
All right, well, we will see if Patrick does better next week after his predictions are posted on our social media handles on Thursday. Let's now turn our attention to college football with a look back at the college football playoff national championship game.
Of course, that game, Ohio State beat Notre Dame 34 to 23. Look, Ohio State jumped out to a huge, huge lead in this game, and Notre Dame just does not have the firepower to come back from down. They need to be playing in a close game where they can kind of not necessarily control the time of possession. They're okay not controlling the clock. They proved that in the Penn State game. But at the same time, they need to be at least within striking distance. And they dug themselves too big of a hole. Obviously, started the game up 7-0 on a really, really long drive, a lot of runs from Riley Leonard, and just a lot of run plays in general. And then it kind of felt like Notre Dame just kind of got gassed after that, like immediately after that drive, that they just didn't have what it took for the rest of the game to kind of bounce back. And in the end, Ohio State went down the field, scored on their first drive, tied it up at 7 apiece, scored two more times before the end of the first half. And I think, we actually talked about this. And I think you're probably going to give your input at the end of this for sure. But look, we talked about this and went back and forth with it. As soon as Notre Dame scored that first touchdown, I said to you on the phone, well, okay, they've showed that they can run it, but they need to stay on. They need to stay moving the chains forward. They can't get penalties. They can't get sacks. They can't do things like that against Ohio State. They don't have the talent to do that. They just have to keep marching it forward because otherwise every drive is going to be stalled and they're going to have too much pressure on their defense. And immediately after it went to 7-7, Notre Dame's first drive after their opening drive touchdown had a 2nd and 25. So at that point, Ohio State gets it back. They get good field position. They score, and all of a sudden it's 14-7. And then again, Notre Dame just goes 3 and out. This time, there wasn't anything that was particularly bad on that set on that third drive from Notre Dame. But again, they had that holding penalty, and then to make it 2nd and 25 after a false start too on that second drive. And I really thought that that's when Ohio State started to get the momentum back, and then 2 3 and outs. Notre Dame's first three drives were touchdown, 3 and out, 3 and out. And Ohio State scored on all three drives in the first half. So they just had too big of a deficit to overcome. Ohio State also scored on the opening drive of the second half because Quinshon Judkins broke out a 70-yard run to the 5-yard line. Notre Dame could not get off the field on third down. They turned it over on downs in their own territory, which gave Ohio State the ball for a field goal to make it 31-7. And they did come back in the end to make it really close, as we know. But at the same time, just when you think that they could have made it close, Ohio State did what it honestly could have done all night if they weren't up by so much. They just threw the ball to Jeremiah Smith. I thought that Notre Dame's coverage on that final play, I don't know if they were expecting a run, but I feel like on 3rd and 11 against Ohio State, with all the criticism that they've taken over the past few years for, losing to Michigan because they don't use their weapons enough, not throwing the ball enough, et cetera, or just getting broken down by that Michigan pass rush, they were going to throw the ball on 3rd and 11. They weren't going to let that game end on a run and then a 3rd and 11 punt and Notre Dame getting the ball on the right side of the 2-minute timeout. That just wasn't going to happen. So I don't really know why the move there coverage-wise was to kind of rush the passer. I mean, I don't even know if it was a run blitz or just a regular pass blitz, to be honest. But if you look back at that play, there was one safety over the middle, and then one-on-ones on the edges with both corners. The defender who was defending Emeka Ogbuka in the middle of the field fell down, which meant that the safety had to come down to Ogbuka anyway. But he wasn't in any position to guard Jeremiah Smith going deep, despite Notre Dame's corner not even pressing him either. So I mean, there were ju th that was a really, really baffling final play call there for Notre Dame on defense. And I think there were some other interesting calls throughout that game. But I think Ohio State on the other side of things, while Notre Dame made some baffling play calls and baffling decisions, Ohio State had really good play calls throughout this game. They knew exactly what to do to get Notre Dame off balance and to keep it that way in the rest of the game. They got Jeremiah Smith the ball in kind of a variety of ways. They didn't really necessarily feature him, only 5 receptions, 88 yards. and a touchdown, and obviously had like 40 yards on that final play, basically. So he wasn't necessarily the feature guy like he was against Texas, where he only had three yards. But look, I think they did what they needed to do, and play calling wise, Ohio State did a really good job of playing off of the attention that he took and finding just wide open guys everywhere else on the field, and also running the ball really well.
So a couple observations, something I'm surprised you didn't mention, because you mentioned it going into the playoffs, and then we thought that the weakness of Notre Dame's had been solved, which was all year the field goal kicking for Notre Dame had been suspect. And you mentioned that, hey, they're making their field goals. If Notre Dame makes their field goals, they're a different team. Well, if they, a lot of people disagree about, agree, or are having, debating whether Marcus Freeman should have gone for the field goal when it was fourth and a long goal. Down 16 to cut it to a 13-point lead. I actually liked the decision. I didn't like the angle. I said before the kick went up, oh boy, this is trouble. The one that went off the upright. The reason why I liked the decision is I thought there was a low chance to get the touchdown and 2-point conversion to cut it to a one score with a 2-point conversion lead. And that by being only down at that point 13, it may have put pressure on Ohio State later to actually try to score. Which again, these are all ifs, but if he had made it, that actually would have come to fruition. And I think it may have changed the outcome of the game a little bit, because Ohio State would have felt the pressure not just to run the ball and all that kind of stuff. So A, kudos to you for saying, hey, this Notre Dame team's different when their field goal kicking's on, but that came back to bite them. I also thought Notre Dame put up a really good fight. I didn't think they'd be able to run the ball effectively. With the injury to their left tackle, they had in, and then stopping the run on with their defensive line. I mean, I thought Notre Dame put up a decent fight, but I actually didn't think this was the team that was going to take them down. I thought it was going to be Texas. Oh, take Ohio State down. I thought it was going to be Texas. I do not understand the call, the defensive call on the third down play. Ohio State was clearly counting on just running out the clock as much as they could. I don't think you need to blitz there. I think you make sure that the one thing you don't do is get hit for a play action pass. They didn't do play action, but just keep the bracket coverage. The only thing that ends the game is a big play. And you know, you should have been able to, I don't know. I disagreed with the gambling on third down, by Notre Dame is what it is. Ohio State coming into the season, everybody thought they were the best team in the country. They did not play like it in a couple games, including obviously the Michigan game. Sometimes a tough loss or adversity is what's needed to wake you up. And unfortunately for those of us who are Michigan fans and who didn't want to see Ohio State buy a national title, Michigan woke them up, and you saw the fully operational Ohio State Death Star during this playoffs. They were clearly the best team in college football. They clearly had the most talent, and they played like it. So, might seem hard coming from me, but congratulations to Ohio State for winning the national title. Congratulations to the Big Ten for having the last two national titles. And speaking of missed field goals, being basically a missed field goal away 2 years ago when Ohio State could have won the game in the last second against Georgia and surely would have beaten TCU. The Big Ten is that close to having two of the last three national champ, three of the, all three of the last three national champions, with two of three belonging to Ohio State. I think that, you know, all the talk of SEC dominance being over, frankly, is legitimate. I think it's good for college football. I think it's going to be extremely interesting to see whether Ohio State then can keep that hunger next year. They're losing a lot of guys. A lot of guys came back to win it, but they still have Jeremiah Smith, which is a scary thought, unless he gets lured somewhere with big money now that he's won a national championship. Overall, you know, a more entertaining, the entertaining game I thought we were going to have in the beginning and in the end. Kudos to Notre Dame for not letting that thing get away from them. It could have been a 40-point game the way Ohio State was rolling. So I don't know, Patrick, if you have further thoughts on this or the 12-team playoff. Obviously, there's another time to talk about the 12-team playoff. I think we all have talked about there being some tweaks, hopefully, that can be made once the new contracts are up for negotiation. But overall, very satisfying. I'm sad to see college football end. It's my favorite sport, my favorite season, and I got to figure out a way to make it through August. I guess baseball starts soon.
Well, the two things that I will add, I'll do one thing on the game and then one thing overall. Notre Dame did not run the ball effectively in this game. They averaged 2 yards per rush. I mean, they only ran the ball in the
only first Riley Leonard drive. Did. Yeah. Yeah.
No, only on the first drive. I mean, he had 17 carries for 40 yards. So they did not run the ball effectively whatsoever. I was actually shocked that he did pass the ball in situations where Ohio State knew he was throwing the ball. I was surprised that he was able to go 22 of 31 for 255 yards and two touchdowns. That was crazy to me. Ohio State did a terrible job of coverage when they knew all Notre Dame could do was throw the ball. But at the same time, they just needed to play safe, and they did. And frankly, they've had issues with playing completely safe in the past. So it did work this time that they played as safe as they could play it. And then on the one final play, they decided not to play it safe. And it was the perfect storm for them. In terms of the overall playoff, I will say that, I don't think I actually saw, not even as a playoff take, but as an overall college football take, something basically that said, watching Kansas State's quarterback hand it off to Ole Miss's running back or throw it to Ole Miss's running back, and he scores after Duke's quarterback threw it to an FIU receiver, and Ohio State got there by beating Ohio State's quarterback throwing it to a Houston receiver. That I think kind of does bother me that, obviously the transfer portal means that basically none of these players started at their schools. Honestly, there are very, very few players on either of these rosters that made big impacts that actually started their careers at these schools. I think, for a guy like Travion Henderson, he deserves a lot of credit for what he did throughout the season and throughout his career at Ohio State. But in the end, it's Quinshon Judkins who's going to get all the praise for running for 100 yards and two touchdowns in the national championship game. So, I don't like that that's where college football is headed, because I think part of the great part about college football is that, all your guys, you only have them for 4 years. And that time is really, really short. And now it's even shorter because it tends to be you only have maybe some of your best guys for 1 year or 2 years, depending on where they transfer from and where they transfer, or where they transfer from and when they transfer. And then on the 12-team playoff note, I think you combine kind of that lack of player continuity and homegrown players with the fact that you can now lose two games and get into the playoff and still have a chance to win a national championship. And I think it's going to cause a lot of teams to, or not a lot of teams, but a lot of fans to just not pay that much attention to the regular season, because, I mean, even earlier this year, we saw Georgia play Alabama, and it felt like, in a past year, that would have ended Georgia's season, that they lost that game to Alabama, that one bad half of football that they played, and it would have ended their season. But instead, they come back. I know they won the SEC championship game, but no two-loss conference champion would have made it, in my opinion. And it's just that kind of aspect does bother me a little bit, because it used to be that, that Georgia-Alabama game, that would have ended someone's season. That Michigan-Ohio State game, that would have been Michigan completely ruining Ohio State's dream season, even with a 1-point loss to Oregon earlier in the year. That was the one loss they could have afforded in the past, and they took that loss. But then again, with Michigan beating them, that would, or if they had beaten Michigan, they would have gone into the Big Ten championship game. And then again, Oregon and Ohio State would have had a rematch, but this time, instead of being in the playoff quarterfinal at the Rose Bowl, it would have been to just get into the playoff in the first place. And then who knows, they might have even played again in the playoff because Oregon could have still made it with one loss. But I think that's the one thing that really does bother me a little bit about this format, is that it really does devalue the regular season in a sport that doesn't have a long regular season whatsoever, and also doesn't base its playoffs based off of wins. It bases them off of 60% preseason rankings and 40% results. So that really does bother me with the playoff. And I think before anybody wants to counter that point about, how important preseason rankings are, BYU, frankly, has any argument that any playoff team does to be in the playoff. But because they were so low in the regular season, in the preseason, and because all the Big 12 was so low in the preseason rankings, they didn't even get a chance to be in the playoff, despite the fact that I think arguably they should have. They're still behind. If you look at ESPN's strength of record rankings, they're behind Colorado still, who they beat by 24 in a bowl game, and also have a better record than. So there are a lot of really, 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 really bad things going on in college football. But at the same time, it's still the sport. It's still the sport that produces all these games. And there have been some very uninteresting playoff games, and I think that's going to continue. So I think overall, my opinion on college football has turned very, very negative with the 12-team playoff, and I'm not a big fan whatsoever. But at the same time, is it hypocritical to say that as a fan of the sport, as a biggest fan of the sport that has 64 teams in its title bracket? Technically, yes, but I think basketball is a different sport, so it's kind of a different conversation entirely. But I would like to say that I'm not a fan of the 12-team playoff, and I would love it if they would go back down to four or even just to six or eight. I'd be totally fine with that. And I don't think I'm alone in that conversation.
Well, A, I don't think that's happening, but too much money. B, I will say one thing as we are about to transition to the NFL playoffs. The NFL, you know, I don't mind having a system where in a sport that's being played by 18 to 22 year olds who might have a bad week or things like that, letting them slip a little bit. As we'll see in the NFL, you know, I don't want it to become the NFL where you can have, you know, four losses, three losses, things like that, and five losses and maybe make a conference championship game. But, you know, a little margin for error for 18 to 22 year olds, or with COVID years, 18 to 26 and medical red shirts, 18 to 26 year olds, however old they are. So young kids, a little margin for error doesn't bother me. I think it makes it made the regular season a lot more interesting for a lot more teams a lot later in the year. I think the format needs to be tweaked. But like I said, that's not happening until new television contracts come up for negotiation, because people need to understand the current system we have was a negotiation. It was not a competitive system set up by a commissioner. There's big changes coming. I think that the one thing we can all say about college football, if you don't like the current system, wait a couple of years, it's going to change. So with that, and all previewing the NFL, let's turn our attention from the end of college football season to the middle, or the middle of the conference, of at least the playoffs in the NFL, with a review of NFL divisional series action.
Well, this is known as the best weekend of NFL games. And also, by the way, that's another thing that I will say about college football, is that putting the playoff championship game on the Monday after the divisional round of the NFL will never be a good decision. They're always going to get good ratings because it's the only thing on anyway, and it's a national championship game. But that probably might need to be looked at, because the NFL, this is the best weekend of the year in the NFL by far. And it was, once again, all these four games, close games, all four of them mentioned earlier in predictions who won. Going deeper into each of these games, I will say, the team that had the most yards in every game this weekend lost the game, which is very, 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 very hard to do. I mean, there are different reasons why it happened in all of the games. But starting with the Texans and Chiefs, which was the first game of the weekend, that game came down to kicking. Houston could not make a kick, and Kansas City could, very simply. Both teams traded field goals to start the game, and you know, it was 6-3 Kansas City after they had kicked two field goals. And then all of a sudden, the Texans missed a field goal and the Chiefs went back down, scored a touchdown, made it 13-3. Texans did make one later to make it 13-6 before the half. But then, you know, in the second half, Houston came out, scored a touchdown. And just when you thought they had the momentum, because they tied the game going 15 plays, 10 minutes on their first drive, they missed the extra point to tie the game. There are like no words to describe how they did this over and over and over again. But then the Chiefs scored a touchdown, made an 8-point game. Houston turned it over on downs, which was interesting, of course, that they went for it on 4th and 10 at the Kansas City 40-yard line. And I have to say, had they made some kicks early in the game, they probably would have just kicked it again. But they didn't. And then the Chiefs, of course, scored later, made it 23-12 on another field goal. And then Houston, at the end of the game, with only a minute 50-ish left, they were driving. They got all the way down to the Kansas City 5-yard line, but C.J. Stroud took two straight sacks, and it was 4th and 14, so they definitely had to kick the field goal, which was, of course, blocked, and that basically ended the game. It ended 23-14 because Kansas City took a safety intentionally. But look, the Chiefs are just doing what they did all year long. I mean, as boring as it sounds to say that, like, Mahomes didn't have an incredible game, but he didn't turn the ball over. They as a team did everything right. I mean, they did not turn the ball over. Meanwhile, the Texans did basically turn the ball over by turning it over on downs and then missing a field goal and having a blocked field goal. So you need to play mistake-free football against the Chiefs, and you also need to have probably a pretty special performance from your quarterback. CJ Stroud was fine. I mean, you know, he was okay. He wasn't terrible. He wasn't great either, though. Taking eight sacks, I know the Chiefs can bring pressure, but you got to get rid of the ball. You got to know better than to take eight sacks on 36 dropbacks. That's a really, really bad number. And lost his team a ton of crucial yards in a game where they ran the ball pretty effectively. And if they weren't behind the sticks so much, they could have won that game. But look, the Chiefs definitely outplayed the Texans. It's still crazy, though, that the Texans outgained them in yards and still lost. And then moving on to the surprise of the week for sure, the Commanders beating the Lions 45-31. I'm not even going to talk about this game. I just want to look at the fact that, or I will talk about the game, of course, but, you know, after the first two drives, you had a punt and a turnover on downs by Washington after Washington had gone 51 yards all the way down to the fourth to a fourth and one on the line in Lions territory on the 28-yard line. And then these teams went back and forth like this until the half. They went touchdown, field goal, fumble, touchdown, 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 pick six, touchdown, touchdown, interception, end of the half. This game just would not stop. And then after the Commanders punted to open the second half after being up 31-21, touchdown, touchdown, interception, touchdown, field goal, missed field goal, interception, end of the game. So it was exactly what you would expect from these two teams. I don't remember how long it was, but the Commanders set like an NFL record for most consecutive drives without a punt or whatever it was, or most consecutive quarters or something earlier in the season, because they just couldn't be stopped on offense early in the year. And that version of the Commanders came to play in the divisional round. And it's exactly what they needed against a Lions offense that always comes to play and always scores. But, you know, the only way the Lions have really ever lost this year is when they've turned the ball over. And I mean, I think, or they didn't even lose the game where Jared Goff actually threw five interceptions against Houston, but that was as close as they came really to losing, other than when they actually did lose in the regular season to the Buccaneers in week two, which Jared Goff also threw two interceptions in that game. So yeah, they lose when they turn the ball over. And in this game, Jared Goff spotted the Commanders some points. He threw a pick six. And then they inexplicably decided to run an end-around pass with Jamison Williams, who is known for making boneheaded decisions, and decided to throw the ball when he should have just eaten the end of the play. There was no reason to throw that ball. You got to throw that ball only if it's wide open. And he threw it on an end-around, and it was a terrible throw, and it got picked off. And that's basically the reason the Lions won the game, or the Commanders won the game, because if you look at it, they spotted the Commanders seven. And the way that the Lions moved the ball offensively, losing by 14 when one of their drives ended in a pick six, take those 7 points off the board and give seven to the Lions, and all of a sudden you have a tie game at 38-38. And that's not even counting the fact that Jamison Williams threw that interception later in the game. So the Lions really did lose this game because of turnovers. But credit to Jaden Daniels, man. I mean, for a rookie quarterback, that was a really, really, really good performance on the road in the playoffs, 22 of 31. 299 yards and two touchdowns, as well as 51 yards on the ground. He really is going to be a force to be reckoned with for a long time. If Washington can build right through the draft in the next few years, they could really start to sustain some success here. I mean, this is not just a this year flash in the pan type of success. They easily can get better in the next few years because they were not supposed to be this good this early, and they already are. So I'm really excited to see the future for this team. And I'm also excited to see them play next week because it's not like their season is over. They're playing the Eagles next week. The Eagles beat the Rams 28-22. As I predicted, Saquon Barkley ran all over the Rams right when it counted. Saquon Barkley ran for a 78-yard touchdown that basically sealed the game. Of course, this game was 16-15 going into the fourth quarter. So the Rams definitely had their chances for sure. They had a chance at the end of the game. They did stop the run when they needed to the most. And they did go down the field and get all the way to inside the red zone. But just not an amazing throw by Matt Stafford at the end of the game. And instead, throw sails wide, maybe a little bit of a hold. Not really going to debate that because I don't really think it was a call that you make in the playoffs on a fourth and 10. But, you know, that game ended because Saquon Barkley ran for 78 and 62-yard touchdown runs. And Jalen Hurts also ran for a 44-yard touchdown run. It's just that the Rams against the Eagles cannot stop the run. Saquon, 26 carries, 205 yards and two touchdowns. The Eagles as a team averaged 8.5 yards per carry and three touchdowns. So Familiar story for the Rams against the Eagles. Meanwhile, Matt Stafford did his thing. He picked apart that team. And I think maybe, you know, if this game wasn't in the snow, maybe the Rams do have a chance because some of those throws that aired wide from Stafford, maybe he has a chance to make a better play. Also, maybe doesn't get sacked as much because he really doesn't have any evasiveness anymore at this point in his career. But at the same time, Eagles definitely deserve that win. They got it. And then, of course, we had the Bills and the Ravens, definitely the most entertaining game of the weekend, in my opinion. Although four really good games, maybe the Chiefs game, not on the same level as the other three. But the Bills won 27-25. Of course, game ended because Mark Andrews dropped a two-point conversion. That's the second time this year that has happened. He did that again against the Steelers way earlier in the year when the Ravens needed to went for two to actually win the game down one, which is an interesting decision. But this time they needed it to tie the game. They went for it. They ran the same play that they pretty much always run on two-point conversions, and Mark Andrews had it wide open, would have had the touchdown, or sorry, would have had the two-point conversion, but he dropped it, and the Bills ended up with the win. I also want to mention that Mark Andrews also fumbled in the middle of the field when the Ravens were driving to make this a closer game. It was 24-19, and they were on their own 40-yard line. Andrews got a 15-yard catch, was in Buffalo territory at the 45, and then Terrell Bernard forced the fumble. Buffalo recovered, scored a field goal, and that field goal, of course, made it 27-19 and ran out all of the clock that was left over until Baltimore went down the field and, of course, missed that two-point conversion. So, yeah, Mark Andrews, not his finest work. It's not all on him, though. I mean, obviously, this was a really, really close game, which means it came down to more than just two plays, but essentially at the same time, it did kind of come down to those two plays. And overall, though, it's definitely the turnovers that killed the Ravens. Fumble by Lamar Jackson and an interception, both pretty early on in the game, early in the second quarter and then in the first quarter. Those really killed some of the momentum that Baltimore had and really ruined their chances of winning this game.
Yep, 2 years in a row, the Ravens just come up short when they're clearly the better team, I think. So unfortunate for the Ravens. Great news for the Bills fans. I was actually hoping for a Bills Lions Super Bowl with the two long suffering franchises. All the Bills have made the Super Bowl four times, just never won it. So unfortunate being a Detroit guy, what's happening to the Lions. What happened to the Lions, frankly, I mean, the way their defense was decimated, it finally caught up to them, right? I mean, this is not the full Lions team. We'll see what happens. They've already lost their offensive coordinator. Rumors are they'll lose their defensive coordinator. We'll see what happens with this team going forward. Hopefully they can maintain this level of success, because those are some great football fans there who deserve a winner. They have a winner, but they deserve a postseason winner. All right, let's shift gears from the NFL and move to basketball action, starting with the most significant college basketball games from the last week.
Well, I spent a lot more time on football than I thought, and you know what? We're going to have a ton of time to talk about basketball in the future, so I'll move through these pretty rapidly. But a lot of interesting results earlier in the week in college basketball. Number one, Auburn beat number 15 Mississippi State, 88-66. Impressive showing without Jani Bruma, player of the year candidate. But then number 21 Ole Miss went on the road and beat number 4 Alabama, 74-64. A really big resume-defining win for that team. If you're going to go out and get wins like that in the SEC, you're definitely going to make the tournament, and you're going to have a really, really high seed at that point, too. Missouri did the same thing. They beat number 5 Florida on the road, 83-82. Florida, just their second loss of the year, coming at home to Missouri, was kind of out of left field, just out of nowhere. But then Marquette went to overtime with DePaul. They did beat them 85-83, but it's a sign of things to come later in the week. Number 8, Kentucky beat number 11, Texas A&M, 81-69, a really big win for the Wildcats. They continue to stockpile really good wins. I think they have 6 quad one wins this year. Number 19, Illinois decimated Indiana on the road, 94-69. Number 24, Wisconsin beat Ohio State, 70-66. Wisconsin starting to play a lot better. They beat USC over the weekend as well. So an impressive week for the Badgers as they continue to add to a resume that really is being overlooked. They haven't lost since like November or late November or early December when they played those conference games. They lost 3 games in a row. They started the season with 8 wins in a row. They lost 3 in a row, and now they've won every single game since. So really interesting, that Wisconsin team. Kind of very baffling, but they have what it takes to go on some big scoring or some big winning runs. So we'll see if maybe they can replicate that in March. Then you have number 25, Arizona, who beat number 25, Baylor, 81-70. Baylor probably shouldn't be ranked, but they are. Then you had number 2, Iowa State. They beat number 9, Kansas, 74-57. Statement win by Iowa State over another contender in the Big 12. Maybe, you know, a little bit of a changing of the guards there with how good Iowa State's been in recent years and some of the issues in Kansas. But then number 6, Tennessee beat number 23, Georgia, 74-56. Georgia just not quite at that level where they can beat the top of the line teams in the SEC. They're still a really good team, but they're just not a great team like some of those other teams are. Number 12, Michigan State beat Penn State 90-85. UNLV beat number 22, Utah State 65-62. And that was the start of a run of upsets. I mean, four straight games where teams out of nowhere just beat the teams that they played. UNLV getting the first one. Minnesota beat number 20, Michigan 84-81 in overtime. That came out of nowhere. That was Michigan's first conference loss of the season. And of course, it came against a winless Big Ten team. Then you have Oregon State, who beat number 16, Gonzaga's 97-89 in overtime. Gonzaga's having a really down year, and I'll get to that later because that was not their worst loss of the week, actually. But then Temple beat number 18, Memphis, 88-81. Temple's revival this year has gone completely under the radar, but they are actually tied atop the AAC standings with Memphis and a few other teams at 4-1 in conference. And they're actually probably the second or third best team in that conference. The sucky thing for them is that that conference is terrible this year and they're not going to get any recognition and they're nowhere near the tournament. But at the same time, they've beaten Memphis once. You know, Memphis is going to be a lock for the NCAA tournament when it's all said and done, probably in March. So, you know, maybe you catch them slipping in the conference tournament. And if Memphis, either if Memphis slips up against somebody else, or if Temple encounters them again and beats them again, maybe they do go dancing, maybe as an auto bid. So it's interesting to consider. Don't know if it's happening for sure, but it might. Then you have number 1, Auburn, who beat number 23, Georgia, 70-68. Again, Auburn just proving that they can beat really anybody in the country, no matter who's playing for them. West Virginia beat number 2, Iowa State, 64-57. Another statement victory for the Mountaineers. Still no Tucker DeVries, but Darren DeVries is leading this team and doing a great job of it. Alabama beat Kentucky. We talked about that in predictions. A really good win for Alabama on the road to bounce back from that loss to Ole Miss. Then a big upset, or two big upsets. Vanderbilt beat number 6, Tennessee, 76-75. For a team that could barely win an SEC game for a few years, it was really, really good to see that upset this weekend. I mean, just definitely, it's what you want to see. This is what college basketball is all about. That program has been down in the dumps for a while, but they are starting to trend up, looking like a tournament team in their first year under Mark Byington. He's not the only guy who's kind of built a tournament roster from the ground up at a new school, but he is doing a great job there, especially given the history of that program that's, you know, not so great. Then you have Xavier, who beat number 7 Marquette, 59-57. Really good win for the Musketeers. Still kind of not even on the bubble formally, I guess you could say. They're getting close to it, but they still need a few more wins to get there. But that one goes a long way towards deciding that. Number 9, Kansas beat Kansas State in their rivalry, 84-74. Number 10, Houston beat UCF 69-68 on the road to claim a quad one win for, I think it was at the time, their first of the year. They actually added another one through net movement later in the week. But then you got Purdue, who beat Oregon. Talked about that one already. Creighton went on the road and beat number 14, UConn, 68-63. Like I've said many times, this is not the UConn teams of old, or not even of old, of the last 2 years. But then you have number 15, Mississippi State, who beat Ole Miss in overtime. Like I said, one of the games of the week. Talked about that in predictions. And I foreshadowed it earlier. Santa Clara beat number 16, Gonzaga, 103-99. I don't think I've ever seen Gonzaga lose a home game to a non-St. Mary's team, ever. And especially not to a team that isn't even really considered a tournament team. I mean, Santa Clara, they're good, but they're kind of in that range, you know, a Xavier, a Wake Forest, a Georgetown range where, yeah, they can beat some good teams, but they shouldn't be going on the road and beating you if you have any high aspirations. They can beat tournament teams at home. They should not be beating tournament teams on the road. So Gonzaga, just a really, really bad loss to take at home. And I don't remember the last time Gonzaga's won 0-2 in a week in the WCC. I mean, it honestly could have been maybe my entire lifetime since the last time they did that, and it wouldn't shock me. But then number 20, Michigan, beat Northwestern 80-76 in overtime. That score is super misleading. That was one of the worst offensive games anybody could ever watch. Don't go back and watch it again. It's also one of the worst officiated games I've ever seen in my life, but that is standard in the Big Ten. Number 12, Michigan State beat number 19, Illinois, 80-78. To not make two fan bases that are very, very mad all the time mad, I won't comment on the officiating in that game, but surely some questionable calls there too. All you need to know is that Illinois' point guard played 9 minutes in that game because of foul trouble. No words about that beyond that, but a really good win for Michigan State. And I do have to say, this is a Michigan State team. You know, everybody talks about Tom Izzo in March, blah, blah, blah. This is one of those teams that's actually that gives him that reputation, because this is the most wins in a row they've had. They've won, I think, 11 in a row now. This is the most wins they've had in a row since the last time Michigan State went to the Final Four, which was 2019. This really is one of the Michigan State teams that I don't think people realize it just yet, but this is going to be one of the all-time teams in that program's history, at least somewhere in the top 10 of their teams, because this team isn't going to lose very many games in the Big Ten. They have one really tough stretch where they take the West Coast trip to UCLA and USC, and then also play Michigan and Illinois again in that span, in I think early February. But at the same time, they'll probably split all of those games and end up with maybe 4 or 5 losses in the whole season. This is going to be a 2 or 3 seed pretty easily, and they're going to make some noise in the tournament depending on who they get in their bracket, because they're not over reliant on one or two players. This is a team that has 10 guys that play 15 to 20-ish minutes a game or more, and only one scorer in double figures, which is Jaden Aiken. So they do have a leader, and they know who they go to at the end of the game. But at the same time, there are no overwhelming scorers, just balanced scoring all around. So whoever has the hot hand is going to be the guy who contributes on any given night. And that's a really good formula to have. And a lot of teams do not have that right now, especially in the era of the transfer portal. But TCU beat number 25 Baylor 74-71. That was another big upset to end the week. But that's all we have for college basketball coverage. I guess I tried to go through that quickly, but still took quite a while. A lot of games this week, and that will continue to be the case in the future.
Well, that's all right. Let's move finally to talk about action in the NBA last week.
Well, the NBA, this is kind of the dull part of the season. You know, no All-Star conversations just yet. That's still about a month out. So maybe, you know, voting obviously will probably start soon for that. If it hasn't already started, I have to admit, been pretty tapped out when it comes to that stuff. But, you know, the NBA, it's in the middle of the season. We kind of have a good picture of who's who now. But there are still some interesting storylines to monitor. And especially in the Eastern Conference, which is kind of interesting because normally it's the boring conference. But we'll start with the Cavs, of course, who are still on that great pace winning wise. They still have an 857 winning percentage. I think, you know, at 36-6, as harsh as it sounds, it might be time to stop doing the can they get to 70 wins counter. They're now on pace for 70 on the dot, so they're not going to get to 72 or 73. I think we already knew that, but you know, it was crazy to see that they were even so close for so long. But then you have the Celtics in second, 30-13. The Knicks are the third seed at 28-16. They are actually third in Vegas odds to win the title, I believe, as well. Tied, I think, with Cleveland, with Boston and the Thunder as co-favorites. But we'll get to the Thunder later. The Bucks are 24-17. They've won 4 in a row. They're 7-3 in their last 10. They're looking pretty good. They have finally turned into the team they're supposed to be. Speaking of turning into the team they're supposed to be, the Pacers have won 8 of their last 10. They are now 24-19 on the season in the fifth seed. The Hawks are at 22-20, excuse me, tied with the Magic, who are 23-21, although the Magic have lost 3 games in a row. Those two teams tied for the 6 and 7 seeds. Then you have the Heat, who are 21-20. Obviously, you want to talk about storylines. Jimmy Butler, that is a very interesting situation. I know Pat Riley has made some comments about what Jimmy needs to do, and they suspended him 7 games for basically conduct detrimental to the team. But Jimmy is not the guy you want to mess with in terms of requesting a trade. If those reports are true, he's not the guy to mess with in terms of requesting a trade and letting him play, because he will do some nasty things in your locker room. And I don't mean nasty in terms of like bad and like anti other players. I mean, we just know that, you know, that there are the stories of him rolling up to the Timberwolves practice and taking literally the worst players on the Timberwolves and beating the starting five with just him and the worst other 4 players he could find in the gym that day, just because that's what Jimmy Butler does. So I'd be careful if I were the Heat. I would not be careful if I were the Pistons about gloating because the Pistons are above 500, 22 and 21 on the season, 7-3 in their last 10. What a run for them. You know, you could see it coming together because they have the talent. I mean, Jalen Duren, Jaden Ivey, Cade Cunningham, all individually have been amazing for really ever since they've been drafted. But, you know, they just couldn't quite put it together as a team. Obviously, they had that ridiculously long losing streak. Either last year or the year before, I honestly forget at this point. But the Pistons, they really have put it all together this year. They've made the right moves. They've got Tobias Harris kind of as that steadying veteran presence, veteran third scorer, if you will. And it's working. Then you have the mediocrity mired Bulls. They are 18 games back, 2.5 games ahead of the Sixers. Bulls sitting at 19 and 25. The Sixers now, after losing 6 games in a row, at 15 and 26 and out of the playoff picture. I don't know what to make of this team. It really feels like they should easily glide into the playoffs, but at the same time, they are halfway through their entire season and they're still 2.5 games out. I don't know how, but it could stay that way. It wouldn't shock me. And regardless, they're going to get the 10 seed because they're 6 games behind the Pistons. They have a lot of ground to make up to even get into a legitimate playoff spot where you either host a game, host one of the play-in games, or only have to play one play-in game potentially. Then at the bottom of the standings, the Nets at 14 and 29, the Hornets at 11 and 28, the Raptors at 10 and 32, and the Wizards at 6 and 35, who've lost 10 in a row. In the West, you have the Thunder, who are 35 and 7. They are 8 and 2 in their last 10, just cruising along, even with no Chet Holmgren. The Rockets, who are 28 and 14, they're 7 and 3 in their last 10, lost last night to the Pistons, though. The Grizzlies are in third, but only a half game back of the Rockets, 28 and 15. It's a race for the 2 seed in the West. The Thunder are already 7 games ahead, then nobody's catching them. But the Nuggets are in fourth, 26 and 16. They are 7-3 in their last 10, really figuring it out. The two LA teams are in fifth and sixth. The Clippers at 24 and 18. The Lakers at 22 and 18. The Mavs have fallen all the way to seventh with their recent struggles due to their injuries. They're at 23 and 20. Just behind them, the Sacramento Kings at 22 and 29 and 1 in their last 10. Really all since Mike Brown's firing, which, you know, you win Coach of the Year, you get fired, your team wins 9 of 10. That just is how the NBA is. I mean, basketball is just a very odd game of momentum. And I really don't think that, you know, they're winning because Mike Brown is gone. I just think they just have kind of, they've hit their stride in the middle of the season. And it just is what it is. They're playing like they were for most of last year until the end of the season. Then the Timberwolves are at 22 and 21. They have kind of fallen out of the good graces of the standings here. And then the Suns are tied with the Warriors. In that 10th spot at 21 and 21 for both teams. The Spurs just looming behind at 19 and 22 on a 3-game losing streak, 1.5 games back of those two teams. And then finally at the bottom of the standings, the Blazers at 14 and 28, the Pelicans at 12 and 32, and the Jazz at 10 and 31.
All right, well, that wraps up our look at the NBA. It also wraps this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next podcast, which will be on Tuesday, January 28th, where we will once again look back at Patrick's weekend predictions. Not once again, but for the first time, I believe ever in the history of the podcast, maybe not ever, but certainly this year and recently, have a look at Australian Open tennis action, trying to fill the gaps here between the end of football season and baseball, the beginning of baseball season. Review NFL Conference Championship action, and we will again talk about basketball with another weekly review of both the most significant games in college basketball and an overview of the NBA. In the meantime, please be sure to check out Patrick's additional content, including his weekly college basketball bracket updates, which will be posted weekly on Wednesdays throughout the season, and his picks for next weekend's games, which, as mentioned previously, will be posted as always on Thursdays. All this content is on our social media handles at 4th and 24. That's the number 4, THAND, the number 24, on Twitter and Instagram, and some of that content on our website, 4thand24.com. Thank you for listening.